This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Kelly McDonald.
I'm Ramya Muthan, and you're about to embark on the complete Kelly and Company podcast experience.
It's full octane Kelly and Ramya with all the fixins.
Live from the Accessible Media Studios, this is Kelly and Company. Entertainment, lifestyle, and great conversation. It's AMI Audio's on-air community, and everyone's invited. And now, the big man himself, Kelly McDonald.
Welcome to March 4th edition of the program as we sail our way through, and we've been commenting on how fast the year is going, but yet we had those lag moments where it sort of seemed, when are we ever getting out of this month? And it's interesting because, Rum, as we talked about here on the show, everyone's perspective of that is so different. If you talk to anybody, oh, January dragged. Oh, we're already here at March.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all over the place. January did drag, no question about it. So did February. But March does feel a little different.
So did the first 4 days of March.
March feels a little better. I know it's super early, but it's still chilly. You know, don't be surprised if you're cold, because I left my window open all night here in the studio room, and I thought, because yesterday was 7 degrees, right? And I was like, wow, that's beautiful. It can't be that bad overnight. But then I came in here and I'm wearing a sweater all day.
Yes. I just like how, but it's cold until like April.
I know it is, but it's because it keeps going up and down. So you don't know which one to fall in love with.
Well,
like, should I make sure it's, or feel better that it's hot most of the time now, or is it?
I think it's been frustrating you because you haven't been able to ski, and this feels like your skiing weather. Well, yesterday didn't quite, but well, yesterday did, because I remember you talking about days you guys would be on the hill,
and it would
be beautiful, sunny, and yeah, it'd be like it was yesterday.
The conditions are not great because it's just mud all over.
That's during your mudding events that you've done in the past, right? You know, but it's really hard. It's really tricky for everyone because, as you say, the weather goes up and down. But I think it's mainly because we just can't do anything as to what we're used to. Anything you do, mm-hmm, including a walk or whatever, the most basic thing, is still affected. You're waving at people, hi, from a distance still, because mm-hmm, we're still dealing, and everybody's just aching for life to get back to normal. So I think that also goes, as much as I tease you about things dragging on as far as you're concerned. And the beginning of March went fast because you've been just indulging yourself so much in our audio book of the month. I think that's
right.
Why.
Yeah, it actually is.
All those naps you take while you're reading.
No. Only last night I fell asleep while reading, yes.
Rewind. Anyway, let's see what's coming up on today's edition of Kelly and Company. No sleeping allowed, please. Coming up on the show, how has the winter affected our trees and shrubs, and what are the next steps in caring for our gardens? Well, we discuss it with our gardener, Susan Kearney.
Writing is heading to the moon. We know who's excited about this, Ryan Huey. Well, we're talking to physicist, entrepreneur, and storyteller Samuel Peralta about how his work is heading to outer space.
Yeah, Ryan really was excited. Even tried to get his works out there. Keep trying. It sounds like a lot of fun, and anyone who likes science fiction, space, all the stuff going on right now, what a time to indulge. Ottawa Community reporter Kim Kilpatrick highlights her first one-woman show, Flying in the Dark, being put on with the Toronto Visionaries. We'll find all the details out and more from her report at the top of Hour 2 right here on Kelly and Company.
Hey, it's Jackie calling from Cumberland, Ontario. Hey, Kelly Mac. My favorite way to have bread is toasted, and there was nothing like the school's toast. I remember going in from home, I remember going in, and as soon as you walk in the bus hall, you smell the toast. I don't know how they did it. I never got my toast to turn out like that, but they made the best toast ever. If it's a sandwich, fried bologna sandwich, but mostly toast.
I can't stand bologna.
Mm.
Mm-mm. Never could. It was something about it. There was some other creative loaf meat that they'd have at the school too, pimento loaf. And I couldn't stand that either. It's just, oh. But regarding what Jackie's saying about the toast, for sure you'd smell it. The other thing, too, is they put a lot of butter on it at that time when she was at the blind school. And that's what she's referring to. So in the morning, you'd go to go for breakfast, and that toast you'd smell a mile away. Now, when I was about 9, I started attending the school, and the thing that threw me off was the fact that the stack of toast on the plate they'd set down one side was brown and one side was white. So I couldn't figure out how, where they were getting loaves that were made that way. Like, I thought, how the heck does that happen? Wow, they just put this in the toaster and you get... Yeah, so that took me a little bit for, you know, in a couple of... dummy, they... Never mind. Yeah, so I totally get what you mean. The only thing is the butter amount. You know, you'd wipe your hands afterward on your cloth napkin. And you for sure better not be forgetting to go to the bathroom after, wash your hands, because you just, everybody smelled like butter. Like they smelled like a walking piece of toast. It was just something else. What do you prefer, brown or white toast? Or toast with a bit more of the seeds and stuff in it?
I like the seeds and stuff lately, but the bougie toast, but also...
Like a 7-grain toast or something else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Some of that kind of stuff. But other than that, yeah, no, I'm a fan of butter and toast. When we were little, it was butter and sugar and toast.
Oh.
That's brown sugar. Was indulging. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember those days. And I think that's where people look and say, "Bus, oh, sure you do remember those days, Kelly. Uh-huh. And how's your health?" There were so many things. I mean, my mother would do that with apples too, put some sugar on it, or salt.
Salt, yep.
Good grief. Let's get away from this stuff, ladies and gentlemen. We'll talk a little bit about lemonade here. A young Alabama girl is helping raise money for her own brain surgery.
Little Liza Scott was diagnosed with brain malformations earlier this year. She'll have the first of what could be several operations Monday in Boston. Her mom, Elizabeth, says the family learned that even their good medical insurance wouldn't cover all the expenses. Little Liza wanted to help, so she set up a lemonade stand in her mother's bakery, Savage's Bakery in suburban Birmingham. So far, she's taken in more than $12,000 in donations. Mom also set up an online fundraiser, bringing in more than $300,000. I'm Rita Foley.
Absolutely amazing. When you think of something like that going on, as if you don't have enough stress already, Rum, you're raising money for your own procedure.
No kidding. And the transparency that goes on in this family, it seems, when it comes to money and funds and really what it takes to get this going for Liza is incredible. And I commend them on that, because it's a lot. And it can be very dark and frustrating and scary. But yeah, you're making it a family effort, and amazing with how much they've raised so far.
An amazing support out there from people. And I think that's such a wonderful thing now. As the more we talk about fundraising events to do that, people being able to have a way to say, here, I'd like to help in some way. Here's another one of those kind of stories, ladies and gentlemen. During last week's devastating snowstorm, two Texas hospital teams came together to save one precious newborn during the chaos. A reporter, Whit Johnson, has that story.
When that dangerous snowstorm ripped through Texas, the staff at Baylor Scott and White Medical Center outside Austin were preparing for the worst.
Rolling blackout every hour or two.
So when Kimberly Arias, pregnant at just 24 weeks, came in complaining of contractions, they were unable to transfer Kimberly to another hospital. Baby Zaylin was delivered at just 1 pound, 6 ounces. Dr. John Lloyd at Dell Children's Ascension Hospital volunteered with two nurses to make a treacherous 2-hour journey with life-saving equipment.
Basically recreating an intensive care unit.
Keeping Zaylin alive for nearly 30 hours before a transport helicopter could arrive.
It was just a huge sense of relief and accomplishment.
Wow, what a story.
Oh my gosh.
Fedora's off to those folks. Baby Zaylin is expected to stay hospitalized for several months while her mom, Kimberly, was discharged and has since been reunited with her daughter. So really great story. And we're going to hear so many of these kinds of stories, Rum, coming out of the storms that were going on and so many things like that. And I always look for these and just, wow, wow. It's unbelievable what people do, what they have to go through, and the lives that are saved by those Herculean efforts that people have to put into it.
Yeah, no kidding, man. I mean, I can imagine the adrenaline that's just pushing you through for all those hours, and still it feels like, you know, the clock is ticking, but that is so, so tremendous.
Yeah, it really is. We will hear more from voicemails a little later on. Robbie dropped us one, and we'd really like to kind of chat a bit about it during the Kelly and Company Roundtable near the end of the program. So stick around. Lots of good talk as Amy Amanti will join us for that. Coming up next, there are mental wellness apps available for iOS, and Michael Fair is going to give us an overview of two accessible ones and what they offer. We'll talk to him when he joins us for his regular weekly session with us here on Kelly & Company. I mentioned the voice messages that we receive, such as from Jackie, the one we'll play later from Robbie. If you want to drop us a message, 1-866-509-4545. Appreciate hearing from you. Mention it's for Kelly & Company, please, so we know what show you're aiming it at. And if give us permission to use it on air if you don't mind. 1-866-509-4545. We've got a few to get through this week, so if you haven't heard yours, definitely we'll do our best to address it. Feedback at AMI.ca and on Twitter. She's at All Rams with a Z, and I'm at AMI Kelly Mack. Ramya Muthan, that's she over there, and I'm Kelly MacDonald.
We're talking a lot of mental health on the show, and it's because it's very, very timely with everything we're going through right now. So Michael Fair is going to continue with that. Let's bring him on.
Hi, I'm Mike Fair. iPhones, iPods, and iPads are everywhere, and they're doing great things for the blind. We explore all that, plus audio entertainment, dramas, podcasts, internet radio, and games. We share it all on Kelly & Company.
We're talking tech today, specifically iOS, but mental wellness is an area of increasing interest to Apple. So they're including breathing and mindfulness minutes in health statistics that are being kept track of on your devices. There's a lot of mental health apps available as well, Michael, for iOS. And back in January, before we did our mini series with tech alternatives, you decided that you're going to thoroughly explore two of the leading apps of this type over the course of this year and give us, you know, lots of information on it. This week, you're going to give us an overview of what these apps have to offer, and especially when it comes to accessibility. So what got you thinking of checking some of these apps out?
Well, you know, it's been a really rough go for a lot of people. They've been missing out on regular things, routines in life, occasions when they see their friends, missing friends and family. I've certainly been coping with a lot of that, and I had a bit of a mental dip, you know, in January, you know, mostly early to sort of late January was when it was probably about the worst for me. February sort of picked up a little after that, but it, you know, sleeping is off. You lose your mental, you just don't quite feel you're fully at 100%. And I thought, you know, these apps seemed like a good idea. They're sort of almost like gyms for the mind, these mental wellness apps. They bring you a lot of different tools from mental experts, you know, people who really think about this stuff, about mental wellness, happiness, how to find it in yourself. And I thought I'd check out two of these apps. It just seemed like a really good combination, you know, to bring that kind of expertise into your home and into your hands and just have that available to you, either privately just to you or to your whole family or other people there. It's a great kind of idea, and I thought I should look into this.
You know, it's really awesome, Michael, and especially appreciate your openness too about the way you were feeling. So when we look at these mental wellness apps like Shine and Headspace, what would you say off the top they can bring to the table?
Well, they throw a bunch of tools in these apps. And first of all, there's the expertise of the people that are involved. Each of these apps usually have at least one mental wellness expert, more likely a lot more of them, many of them freelance mental wellness coaches, things like that. And they'll have a crew of these experts. They'll bring content, either videos or audio production that you can listen to. And they'll coach you through exercises, activities to help sort of form better mental habits and mental awareness. You know, we kind of go through our mental lives thinking things, often kind of negative things about ourselves, and we're not even aware fully consciously that we're doing it. So these really encourage awareness, focus, and taking charge of your mind and your thinking, and especially about yourself and what you bring to the world. And it's they offer sort of tools to sort of generate better mental habits. They encourage things like journaling, meditation is a big part of it. They encourage sort of awareness, reflection, all that really kind of healthy stuff that we should all be sort of doing, but we get so wrapped up and busy that we often don't.
Yeah. And the cool thing is you're obviously building community as well, because everybody who's using an app like this has a community of other users of the app.
Yeah, the community is a big part of these and ongoing discussions. So it's not just a one-way street. They're telling you stuff, and then they're asking, how are you doing? And you will write a journal entry. You'll write a response to questions just to make, not even for them, but for you, to make you think and be aware of your thoughts, get them out, get them down and written in community, mm-hmm. on different platforms. A lot of these apps will, their staff will host a community, and that's important because they moderate it. They keep it a nice place, a positive place where people can share their thoughts safely. And that's really critical to really personal discussion like this. So that is another sort of tool that they most of these apps, at least the ones I've looked at, will offer.
Okay, so let's talk about how you're going about exploring these apps and where some of them came from.
Okay, so I've basically in January, early January, basically right after New Year's, I decided I was going to do this. And I chose two kind of different apps. One of them is Headspace. It's a kind of a traditional app of this type, pretty much heavyweight, very famous, got a big audience. And basically, it's an English fellow who dropped out of university, started traveling around the world, became an ordained Buddhist monk in India after about 20 years of exploration, and decided to come back to England. And he wanted to bring those benefits of meditation that he discovered in his travels all over the world back to UK society. And he met a stressed-out advertising executive, and the two of them hooked up and made Headspace. And it's since grown into a very successful one of these apps and communities. Shine is a bit different. It's basically 80% BIPOC. And a couple of women from the U.S., one of them is half Japanese, and the other one is Black. And they both just felt that they were missed. The rest of the industry was kind of too pricey, too privileged. Basically, they felt othered. You know, they felt that their traumas, their experiences weren't sort of counting with these other apps. And so they decided to make one themselves and really made a community that supported these disadvantaged groups that felt left out by the other offerings. So I thought, you know, surely something like that. It got Apple's attention last year. It won Best App of 2020. And I thought, you know what, this maybe I should look at this. How usable is an app like this with VoiceOver now for blind people who might want to do this? And so I picked that up, and I thought maybe they might have different focuses, different vibes, different thinking on mental wellness, given, you know, the history of repression, the history of, you know, everything from slavery to being ignored to all the rest of it. Like what have they brought to the table to sort of help cope with that?
Excellent. So when you look at it, Mike, what experience with mental wellness and meditation do you bring to the table?
Well, you know, meditation was not something I've taken very seriously. I mean, I do have my own techniques for mental wellness, journaling being one of them. I have blogged. I used to blog quite regularly for years. And so that I know is a very powerful help. Meditation, though, I'm a little lighter on. I learned a bit from in actually health class in school. We covered it a bit. And also summer camps, things like that. There would often be kind of mental wellness things. So I've had sort of dribs and drabs of it. But it has never been a big part of life. So this was kind of a new thought to try and sort of approach it systematically, like these apps encourage. You're really supposed to do this daily. And I'm not as good at the daily part, but I am trying to explore these and really pick up these habits.
Yeah, good point. I mean, maybe some of us have dabbled in some of these things, especially when we know that other people are talking about it or it's becoming a big thing. But the daily habits and making it a lifestyle is really a learning process. Michael, to keep it transparent as well, how do these apps make their money?
So basically, they are subscription-based, at least, again, the ones I've seen. There could be more models that I haven't encountered. But all the ones I've heard of, and certainly these two, Headspace and Shine, they offer some content for free. So the apps are free. You don't pay for the apps. And you can try the free content. And then to get the rest, the big library of resources and more sort of mental coaching availability and different things, they'll offer a bunch of extras and they'll say subscribe to get these extras. So you're paying a monthly or yearly subscription, and that is where they generate their income. I haven't seen any sort of other purchased things or anything like that that I've noticed. I've poked around for that. So you can't sort of, the subscription seems to cover everything as far as I can tell.
Yeah, that's awesome. How do these apps try to stand out from each other?
Yeah, they're both kind of, I mean, there's a sort of core of ideas that are very similar. So they really have to find ways to stand out. Sometimes it's audience focus. Shine certainly would qualify as that. They're really focused on basically the Black, Indigenous people of color, women. They're very, very female-centric. Most of the coaching I hear on Shine is women. So that could, skew things in that direction, I suppose. One reviewer suggested some men might feel uncomfortable. I don't. I guess thinking back, I learned most of what I did know about meditation from women. So it seemed natural to me. That's one thing. There's audience focus. There's also the tools and the focus on which tools are they centering their efforts on. Shine really encourages reflection and writing. Journaling is a big, big part of their focus. I find Headspace is a bit different. It focuses more on giving you techniques and guiding you through them. And they do offer check-ins and things, but it's more kind of how are you feeling, 1 to 10 kind of stuff. They don't really get your writing as much, I find. So there are different focuses, different experts, the people, right? And the people they have, first of all, there's their crew of experts in each app. And then there are the people they pull in, the famous, the celebrities they get. So Calm, for example, is another one of these apps that my wife uses. And it has a bedtime story read by Matthew McConaughey. Kevin Hart is on Headspace, apparently. I've heard the name. I think he's a comedian. I haven't really heard a routine of his. But if you pay for the subscription, part of what you can find on Headspace is his meditate. I believe it's a series of meditations. They also kind of branch out, reach out in different ways. Headspace has a Netflix series. That you can, the Headspace Guide to Meditation, you can find it on Netflix if you're subscribed to that. So they'll do these different things, and Shine does similar. They reach out, they have a community, a portal for virusanxiety.com, I think it was, and you can go there for free, and there's a bunch of resources that they make available to everyone in partnership with a mental association in the States. So they both are making these big gestures and doing what they can to help to differentiate themselves. It's a neat time to be looking into this.
It definitely is super timely, and we'll hear more about Headspace and Shine, as you said, over the next little while as you dig deeper yourself into it. Thank you so much, Michael.
A pleasure. We'll see you next week.
Both Shine and Headspace are available free in the App Store. And Michael will be back next week to talk more tech and audio entertainment.
And I'm sure we'll hear more from Matthew McConaughey. Just keep hearing that name everywhere. In a moment, ladies and gentlemen, we visit with our gardener, Susan Kearney, right after this break. We heard a message from Jackie earlier in the program about toast, which I was remiss in asking Rumya if she took her walk to the bakery yesterday to get more of that Greek pastry. So, yay or nay?
No, I did not go on a walk. I went on a walk, not to the bakery.
Oh, okay. See, I'm surprised you're even admitting the walk after what you said about falling asleep listening to my book. I haven't really done anything. So I thought,
for once,
the book overruled the stomach.
Yeah.
Wow. Awesome. I think it's probably because the dog was, let's go. I think that's probably what took care of it all.
Yeah.
Welcome back. It's Kelly and Company, Rumya Muth and Kelly McDonald. We are the hosts of the show. We're here weekdays from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern. First repeated the show at 5 o'clock, midnight, and then 5 a.m. in the morning. And, of course, we're available via podcast wherever you are. Thanks for checking in with us. It's time to talk to our gardener, Susan Kearney.
Hello. I'm Susan Kearney. Join me on Kelly and Company to learn about the joy of gardening by using touch, taste, scent, and sound.
Other than missing the flower show, Susan, I have to ask you, we're talking about the month of March, and what kind of implications does it have for this time of year when dealing with our garden? Like, what's it doing to our trees and shrubs, for example?
Well, I'll first say yes. I will definitely miss again this year the garden show Canada Blooms, but and March I won't miss it. I like it to go very quickly because I always think it should be spring.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, it March just feels like it should be, right? And even as a kid, we always felt March and with spring break and everything like that. So for you guys as gardeners, is it almost like that everything's pending, you know, based on how warm, what kind of weather, how much rain? There is so much that tells the toll in March and April, the beginning of April, for that garden.
Absolutely. And I'm finding this year there is so much ice. Like yesterday, it was quite mild. It was very nice. The sun was out. But then overnight, of course, it went down very cold again, and everything froze. It's all that ice is actually freezing on our trees, and when it's warm like it was yesterday, the trees have a lot of moisture in them. Our trees and our bushes, of course, have a lot of moisture inside them. And when it freezes, like it is today, and Tuesday was very cold, it cracks our trees. It cracks the branches. It can actually crack the trunks. And that has to be taken care of.
So is this different? Because I have to ask, I know that March is kind of this pull this way, pull that way month.
Yeah.
That's not the same for Jan and Feb, or at least the dead of winter months?
It can be, and it has been. I think we are definitely seeing more of this during our winters. And in fact, I think some of February, even some of January was sort of like March.
Yeah.
I guess that's why it all feels the same.
Really up and down with the temperatures.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was, and I do know in my garden, I know there are several things that are going to have to be replaced. One is an old lilac tree. I don't exactly know how, but it's dead. It's just gone, and it's standing there. So we're going to have to get an arborist in to take it out because it is large. And I'm just hoping that it doesn't fall onto anybody if they're out. Well, that part of the yard is totally in ice. Garden is totally in ice right now. But That is another reason why we have to take care of these trees when there's all this freezing, because when the limbs become weak from the freezing or from high wind, and wind is another thing that we get a lot of in March, then those limbs can come down onto, you know, onto people, onto property, and do a tremendous amount of damage. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That is really incredible. And when you talk about bringing the arborist in, when would you do that? Would you do that, you know, obviously, when the ground thaws, everything like that, yeah, because you can't do anything until then, because we're talking about the full removal.
Yeah, and, I don't want anybody slipping on the ice in my garden.
Not to mention, I think the ground might have a little, I'm going to resist you pulling these roots up,
that's
too,
right.
as it's as frozen as it is. But these are the things, Sue, that... It's that taking stock, and like I think you solved Ramya's problem earlier with the whole just beginning of the year is taking so long, because it does. It's like January, the weather has been really up and down enough that each month has been the same. It's not like we've had a distinct difference. So going back to my, what I'm trying to ask is simply, when would you be able to basically deal with that lilac, and would you be able to discover at that point whether, you know, with the arborist, what kind of happened? Was it really just due to the weather, or what else could have?
Well, actually, we've already contacted one. This is a good time to if you can safely get out to your garden, and I'm saying, because there are areas of my garden that are not safe to walk in right now. It's very, very icy. So if when you can start to get safely out there, and I'm hoping in the next 2 weeks, we'll see how much other damage has been done to the bushes, what may have to be removed. Mm-hmm. And we definitely know that that one lilac does have to be removed. There's another area by one of our fences. We've noticed that there's some damage, only because of the ground. When it freezes, when it thaws and then freezes like that, it also lifts up. It moves too. It's got all that moisture, and then it freezes, and then it's, and I really have, I don't know whether it's because I'm here all the time, so I've noticed a lot more of it this year, but I have noticed a lot more this year. So I don't know, I guess other people, it'd be interesting to know if other people are finding the same thing in their gardens. And I'm hoping in the next maybe 3 weeks that we can have someone at least give us an assessment of, removing some of that, the dead trees, or even looking at some of the other. I have an enormous maple tree that may have to be looked at too, because I don't want those big branches coming down. They could cause an awful lot of damage.
Mm. And is there something we can do on our own? I mean, I don't know about any preventative, like covering our trees from the ice and snow. But, you know, is there something else that we can do aside from getting professional help to make sure that they're cleaning up?
How much is the ground too, Sue? Like you said, everything's icy. Is it more the ground, or is it above ground? Like, I know we've got to watch those branches and everything hitting us. Yeah. But if it's is going to hurt a tree, it's the ground level and below, isn't it?
So some of it will be, yes, and a lot of it is the limbs and also the trunks of the trees. I don't know how much damage can be done to the roots, but I suspect there might be some because there's so much ice. I don't remember ice like this other years. It's just not covering everything. It really is covering a lot of, like, underneath my trees, and I don't want to even walk on it.
Because you're talking about the trunk damage too, right?
Yes, the trunk damage, and also, there might be some root damage. That's another thing. If you have trees in your garden, or and you think that there might be, because, you know, a lot of trees, the roots are above the ground. You can feel them above ground. So, yes, there might be some root damage done, too. And then, of course, that's very serious, because then the wind will come along, and guess what happens to that tree?
Yeah.
Comes down. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And I guess with the trunk, too, you get those other issues of what it, you know, what it needs. You could suffocate it almost like in its a length of life there. So when can we really safely go out there and start messing around and doing stuff?
Well, I'd like some of the ice to go away. I'm hoping in about 3 weeks we can get someone in to look at everything and start. I think because I have a feeling that come April, and I could be wrong, but I think we're going to suddenly go right into a very warm spring. I usually, if we have this kind of winter, you know, up and down, then usually we have a very quick and warm spring. We don't have that, you know, lovely sort of cool spring where everything. So then you have to be very careful, because if your trees and shrubs aren't healthy, they will attract, you know, disease and insects. They'll come and feed on it because they're unhealthy. I would say in many areas, I would say perhaps 3 to 4 weeks, you should actually be taking stock, getting someone in to look at any damage that has been done or replacement of shrubs that have been damaged from this.
Okay. Well, it sounds like, I don't know, but it seems to me that in the last few years, we've had several of these kind of segments with you where we're saying the winters are getting milder. Mm-hmm. And even, mm-hmm. you know, going from summer to fall, you're talking about how it's getting a little stickier with when to bring the plants indoors, right? Remember we were talking about that? Yeah, because mm-hmm. we have such hot days and then the nights are getting really, really cold. So that's also damaging. It's really interesting to see like how people are feeling about this stuff and how our plants are being affected by the mild weather.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It is different. I would say that this March probably, I would have called it February, maybe 20 years ago. That's the kind of weather we're getting. It is interesting. We are definitely the planet. You know, we are seeing some very big climate change every mm-hmm. year. So, yeah.
Yes, we are, mm-hmm. and it kind of changes the way we. It's not like you can deal with this side of the planting and then say, okay, but summer we're going to be back to normal, right? It affects everything moving forward mm-hmm. with seeding and planting and harvesting and everything.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think everything is. I think everything has sort of changed. That you know, what used to be 1 month has maybe moved into another month, another cycle. So yeah, it will. I think we are going to go into a very, very warm spring very, very quickly. Could be wrong, but that's my prediction.
Well, as a gardener too, it must be interesting over the years, all the years you've put into working mm-hmm. on a garden, the shifting you've seen, then also the return, things that go and you think, oh boy, I guess we're really moving into a new pattern. And yet that kind of cycles back around. And certainly you've seen the things that just don't come back, just aren't
absolutely.
The same ever again. And
no, that's true. Yes, absolutely. Or I wouldn't be able to put a plant in a certain area now because it may be too warm.
Yeah.
During the summer. Yeah.
And soil change, everything like that, which some of that is the natural progression of use of it, I'm sure, too, that you notice. But it's those changes, I guess, the more concerning are the heat, the warmth, the cold, and pollution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
thanks,
Suze. Absolutely. Bye.
We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks when Susan joins us. Every second Thursday right here on Kelly and Company. We're going to take a break, ladies and gentlemen. Let's get into a subject we had with Ryan Hui on Friday. Writing is heading to the moon. We speak with physicist, entrepreneur, and storyteller Samuel Peralta about how his work is headed to outer space. To the moon! We'll be right back with that conversation after this. Earlier, I was mentioning ways to listen to the program at your convenience. Well, podcasting, easiest way and most reliable for you, using your favorite podcatcher, the one that you're most comfortable with. Do a search for us, Kelly and Company, and take a listen. Subscribe. If you wouldn't mind, give us a rating and review, but mostly take in the show in the best way that suits you, whether it's the segments of the program or the full, complete Kelly and Company podcast experience, where we toss in an audio vanity card today, presented by Rumya Muthan for you. Check it out. It's the Kelly and Company Company podcast using your favorite podcatcher. Kelly MacDonald in the London, Ontario home studio. Ramya Muthan in the home studio in Toronto.
We're going to have some really interesting conversation right now, Kels, because our next guest has some of his work heading to the moon. We talked about this project last Friday. You heard correctly, the moon. So physicist, entrepreneur, and storyteller, and a bunch of other accolades. But we'll start with those three. Samuel Peralta is joining us right now to talk about this work. Samuel, thank you for coming on Kelly & Company.
Hi, thanks for inviting me. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. So we're just wondering, was Earth just getting too boring for you? Is that why you're sending your work to the moon?
No, thanks. It was it was an opportunity that came up, actually. 50 years ago, the Apollo project landed on the moon, and that was the last time we heard of it, as you know, the Perseverance lander has landed on Mars, so everything about space is big again. And the NASA put out a commission for commercial landers to the moon. In other words, NASA wasn't manufacturing its own lunar landers anymore, but it wanted private companies to build them. So a company named Astrobotic out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, put together a lunar lander on its own, and NASA commissioned them to put their payloads on the moon. There was extra space available on the lander, and so Astrobotic made that space available for other people to obtain payloads, and I and some other people obtained some space on the lander for payloads, and that's how it happened.
That's phenomenal.
Wow.
Wow. Samuel, we'll get into some more of what else you know is going to go in that as part of that payload. I mean, this is really, really fun when you think about it. But what also is interesting is, as we introduced you here on the program, we had to stop and say, wow, this is a very diverse gentleman, man of many trades, physicist, entrepreneur, storyteller, author, and award winner. Tell us a little bit about your diverse background.
Well, I've finished a career in the energy industry, working essentially in nuclear plants and putting together robots to inspect nuclear plants. So that was a very exciting time in my career. On the side, I wrote science fiction stories, and I didn't have the time to look for an agent or anything like that. So I published them myself along with other people's in anthologies. And to my surprise, the anthologies took off. They hit the number one lists on Amazon. I published another one. And now we've got about 25 books, all of them bestsellers on Amazon. I hit the USA Today bestsellers list, as well as the Wall Street Journal's bestseller list. And I mean, that's just been amazing to me, because really it was myself sharing my anthologies with other people and just bringing that pleasure of being published to other people. And it just has been a great success. After that, some of the stories that I published were filmed, and they streamed on Netflix in the Love, Death, and Robots series. Wow. I started looking around for other things I wanted to do. And one of the things that I like to do is to inspire other creative people. So I said, I'm interested in film. I'm not very good at filmmaking, so why don't I help produce short films? So essentially what I do is I find very promising filmmakers and their films, and if I like it, I essentially help them start out, give them some seed money to film. And one of the films I helped produce essentially went on to win an Emmy. So
wow.
If you bet on the right horse, the horse wins.
Wow, Samuel, that's amazing. And you know what's happening now? Like, you know, the producers, Ramya and Jeff, who produce our show here, they're thinking, geez, how many segments could we get out of this guy? This is great.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Just getting to the tip of the iceberg today.
Oh yeah,
it's a very funny career that I've got here, but it's been exciting, and as long as it's interesting, I'll do it.
Exactly. And you kind of got your fingers in everything, which is amazing. And it all plays out to help everything else out. So the project that you're part of is Writers on the Moon. That's kind of the payload of things that are going to the moon that you talked about with Astrobotics. So can you tell us a little bit about this particular project?
So how it started out, well, Riders on the Moon is just one of the three projects I'm in that are going to the moon, actually.
Okay.
The first I heard about it was last year. And essentially what has happened is this company called DHL, and you know DHL, the package company, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They essentially launched a new service that says, send your package to the moon. We'll send anywhere on Earth, and we'll send one to the moon. And so if you book a moon box with them, you can send something to the moon. It's not that cheap because it takes a ton of money to send a kilogram of stuff to the moon. But you can send data, and data in a memory card isn't so heavy.
Right.
So the first package I sent up is a very personal package. It's essentially a memento. I sent that in October to Astrobotic. And then around January this year, I was invited to join Riders on the Moon. And it was started by Susan K. Quinn, who was a former rocket scientist and is now an author as well. And that's how I know her. I've published her in my anthologies. And so she basically asked a group of friends if they'd like to join her on the moon. She's sending 125 people on the moon. And so all of them are putting their books together and sending them on a data card to the moon. Now, I publish not just my own books, but also anthologies. Every anthology has something like a dozen people on it to about 20. So when I send a book up, it's not just my stories going up in the moon, but it's the stories of all the people that I've worked with. So when I send up 25 anthologies, I'm essentially sending up a lot of people. And right now, at last count, I was sending up about 400 people in the Riders of the Moon project. And that's just taken off like crazy. People are just talking about it because it's something that's a little different. And we thought that it would give hope to people during this pandemic time as well, where people are basically stuck at home. But with this project, you give them some hope, and you also let them look out at the moon. It's different. It's something to look forward to.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And like you said, what a way to get a bunch of things up there in that format, something very unusual. Can you talk about some of the other things that would go up with the payload, as you mentioned, and how are they, give us a picture, how are they placed and stored up there?
Sure, I'll give you a picture of that. Right now, along with my books, I've also put up screenplays, such as for the screenplay for the Emmy-winning film. I put up music. I was commissioned to write the song for my high school, and my high school is a very old high school. It's celebrating its 400th year.
Wow.
It's one of these old Spanish high schools back in the Philippines. So I wrote that with my brother, and the score is going up. There's some artwork going up. And then last week, after I talked to you over email, I got the idea. I said, wait a minute, I'm sending up some artwork. Why don't I send up more artwork? So what I did was I scrounged up around to find anybody who had still some space left on any memory cards they were sending to the moon, because the deadline was March 1, right? Mm-hmm. I found a few people, and basically what I did was I reserved all of the space that they had left. And so last week I spent all the time sending up catalogs of art to the moon. So I essentially last week sent up 800 artists to the moon. So right now, that total of 400 creative people that I'm sending up to the moon personally has ballooned to about 1,200 people. It's just been phenomenal. So right now there's artwork. There's poetry that's going up. And I like to say we've got 1,200 human creatives going up and one AI, because one of the projects I've been working with is writing poetry with an artificial intelligence.
Cool. And
so that poetry is also going up on the moon. It's still to be published. It's going to be published soon, but there you go. We've got a robot who's written poetry, and it's up on the moon.
That is awesome. You talked about the memory cards and things like that. Anything else you want to say about how things will be sitting on the moon, literally? And tell us when and where the launch is going to happen as well before we go.
Okay, so the memory card is inside what's called a moon box, and that's a hexagonal container. And there are maybe scores of these moon boxes that are put into an oval capsule that they call the moon pod. The moon pod is held in Astrobotic's Peregrine Lunar Lander, which will also deposit some NASA payload. So we will be alongside some NASA instruments in that payload. When it will be launched from Cape Canaveral, late 2021. Right now they're thinking July, but it may be delayed. And that'll be launched through a ULA Vulcan Centaur rocket. It will deposit the Peregrine lander in orbit around the moon. It will land, and that moon pod that it's carrying will essentially be archived on the moon in perpetuity for future generations to discover.
So wild. Well, this is amazing. And honestly, we'd love to have follow-up conversations with you closer to the launch and things like that, because it's really awesome. But Samuel, we got to go. So thank you so much for coming on and engaging us in this topic.
Thank you for inviting me. It's been fun.
It has been fun. We were talking to physicist, entrepreneur, storyteller, author, and award winner Samuel Peralta about his work heading to the moon.
My gosh, he's busy. But these guys here, they'll try to put him to work for more. A wonderful conversation. In the next hour, we chat with Andrea Voss from CNIB Smart Life about Lego Braille bricks. Today's special guest for the roundtable conversation is Amy Amante from Vancouver. But up next, Ottawa Community Reporter Kim Kilpatrick with her community report.
When you tune into the show in the middle of an interview.
Number 9 is don't believe everything you read on the internet, which is where I got this from.
You're listening to Kelly and Company on AMI Audio.
Welcome back to the program. Ramya Muthit, Kelly McDonald, hosts of the show. Thank you, wherever you are, for being with us around the world, listening in. Thanks a lot for your time, folks. So, Ram, would you say thumbs up that segment with Samuel? Probably needs a little more discussion tomorrow on Cut for Time.
Yes. Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Told Mr. Ryman to pull some stuff, and we'll see. We'll have a little bit of a conversation as we do our Cut for Time at the end of tomorrow's program, a new segment that we've been doing. Because we're left feeling that way, we feel bad enough cutting the guests off, let alone not getting a chance to throw some of the things in that we may have wanted to say and are saying, no, we can't. We got to get to the other business at hand. So we'll do that on Cut for Time tomorrow. But he had so much to say. So cool.
So cool. And we know it's a summer project. And I know it's almost done. Well, according to Samuel, it was March 1st was the last day to kind of contribute to what he's part of, right? But I feel like there's just so much more to learn about it. I feel giddy. Like, it's very exciting.
I was giddy over all the things he's been involved with, as I'm sitting there saying you guys could make more segments out of, but there's just so many interesting things.
Tons.
From his work to the Netflix series, things like that, that we can go, I got to go check that out. So really wonderful. Really appreciate his time joining us on Kelly and Company today. It's time to check in with one of our community reporters, Kim Kilpatrick. She joins us with news from Ottawa. But I got to say that the big news for us as far as Kim Jimmy's concern is CBC Ottawa's Trailblazer Award 2020. Kim, one of the names that comes up that Karen McGee was sharing with us, and I also noticed on the gala, the CCB did, was you. Yours truly. Congratulations.
Yeah. Well, thank you, guys. I knew about it since 2020, but it was a weird time. Apparently, they get hundreds of applications, and a friend of mine nominated me for it, and I was given that, but they said not to say anything because they were still hoping to have an in-person gathering in 2020, and of course, then COVID came, and there was none of that. So a couple months ago, they said, okay, we're going to do the 2020 and 2021 together, but it's going to be, you know, over a video call, kind of. And I'm really honored that I was nominated and got in the top 10 of, because it's 10 people a year, I guess. And it was sad, though, a bit, because the video call, you also had to stay mute unless they asked you a question. And, of course, I couldn't see everybody else that was there. And so you couldn't network with anybody. You know, you couldn't do it. And they sent us a box of gifts, but they said, don't open it until we're all together. And then when I realized when I opened it, I had no idea what was in the box. You know, these things where you, it's like, oh, there's paper here. I don't know what it is. Oh, there's some sort of a plaque thing, but I don't know what it says. There's the only thing I knew were cookies, but they were wrapped up. So I wasn't even sure they were cookies. So it was a kind of, I don't know, like, I don't want to say I'm not grateful, I am, but it was a bit of a letdown. You know these experiences where you win something and then the stuff is not accessible, like the ceremony is not, or the stuff they give you is not appropriate for you? Like, I don't mean to be ungrateful, but it's one of those things where they admire you for work on accessibility, but then they're not accessible. You know, yeah. You know, I'm, yeah. I guess
it's
I sound,
irony
I
for
sound
sure.
nasty. I'm sorry. But
yeah, especially when you get down to where you're not sure if the cookies are, to, you know, like for putting drinks on or coasters of some kind or what.
Yeah, because they were in this cellophane bag and they felt kind of hard and I kind of squeezed. And then it was like, oh, I think this is food in here. But I hadn't opened it. Like, you couldn't smell them because they were in this. And they had, like, CVC logo on them and icing, I think. But I was like, they were kind of, like, crushed a little bit after. And the lady who nominated me said, well, no one held up what they won. So she didn't even know, like, she was there. But she texted me right after and said, what did you win? I said, I have no idea. Whatever, all this great stuff.
Yeah, I tried to put this cookie back together, but I spelled CBC wrong.
CBC, well, luckily it's the same both ways. I don't know.
Exactly.
I don't know. It was. So I did email them about that, which I felt a little bit, you know, I mean, you feel honored when someone does something. But the thing is, don't we think the whole process has to be accessible and thought through? You know, they could have sent me a note with, here's what you're going to find in your box and this is what it is, you know, kind of. Even just that, like even just an email that says, here are the items in your box and what they're going to be, I guess, you know what I mean? But then you feel kind of as if you're being like
critical.
Ungrateful, but
yeah. But you make the point, especially the accessibility and especially since, you know, I'm looking here at the release they give and so much of it is about things that you've done to help people, to help accessibility along, whether it's education, computers and you know, get together with technology, whether it's mentoring other people for storytelling and stuff like that, and including talking about, you know, your experience to go wanting to get another dog and everything like that is exemplary discussion about accessibility. And you know, so you kind of feel, but you'd like to think they would expect you to say something because that's why you're getting the award.
Well, I did say something and they did say, oh, yes, of course we should have, you know, like they didn't do it on purpose.
No,
you know,
didn't know. I'd just be concerned that they would offer you new cookies.
It would have been, they should have sent me more cookies. They were good, those cookies. But, other thing that would have been nice is to get together with everybody, because there were amazing people who were nominated, and you'd hear a little bit about them, but you just wanted to know more and be in the room together and just network, you know, with those people and talk about what they were doing and how they felt and what they were experiencing. So that was the thing that made me sad, kind of, too. You know, that whole, you missed that part, definitely.
Yeah. But late for your own recognition. A little bit.
Yes.
Yeah.
A little bit. But
well, still, congratulations. Nice. Yeah. Congratulations, yes. Kim, because your work is tremendous. Like, you do so much. Kelly was just mentioning a couple things, but you do a lot, and it's great to have that recognition because people need to know how hard you work and how involved you are, especially with accessibility. And true to your word, you sent them an email, so which is great. Let's keep going with your community report. The Undercurrents Theater Festival. Tell us about this. It's going online.
So this is Ottawa's version of the Next Stage in Toronto, which is the winter version of the Fringe. I performed there a couple of years ago, did our show a few years ago there at the Undercurrents Festival. And it is totally online this year from March 10 to March 20. And the tickets are pay what you can. And I put the address on the blog, but it's undercurrentstheaterfestival.ca. I noticed there were a few ASL performances. There were no audio described that I came upon. But they have hired me to kind of be a secret shopper or a secret listener, I guess, this year to go on their site, like to go to the festival. They've given me a free pass so that I can attend and see how accessible the online platform is and how accessible, you know, the site is and all of that. Because they want the fringe to be, will be in late June. They want it to be some combination of the two. So they want some of it to be in person, but they're pretty aware that this won't happen totally. I think we've all agreed on that, that there's going to be some hybrid model for a while now. So they're keen to make sure that this is as accessible as possible. So they asked me if I would do that for them. And I was planning to attend some anyway, so I was perfectly happy to do that for them. And so far, I haven't tested the platform, but so far the site seems really quite accessible. And so that's very good news for that.
That's a nice thing to be able to say, right? Because as we were just talking about accessibility, you want to be able to give some of the positive feedback. And hey, guys, we are getting there. And let's be fair, there's a lot of things being done now. People are making the effort and we're getting somewhere compared to 20 years ago.
Yes, yes, we are. And people generally want to do it. I mean, it's not like they don't want to do it. It's just they don't know until you pointed out what the situation is. And so I'm really happy that they are asking me to do that and taking my feedback into, you know, consideration when they, as they proceed to the fringe.
Awesome.
And beyond that, I guess, on to next year.
Okay.
So that's awesome.
Update on e-scooters.
Well, one sentence, they've been approved. No matter what we did, they've gone through for a second year trial. We don't know what that will look like yet, but I guess in coming months, I'll tell you if there's things. We're going to try to organize some protesty type things to let everybody know that this is not a great idea. But and I know Toronto, they're really working on getting them not approved. So stay tuned for that. But my counselor voted against them, but she was the only one. So and hers is the ward. She lives in this ward where I am. And this is the ward where they were most impacted last summer. So I kind of felt it was a bit of a slap in the face to her. I mean, she saw them the most, right? And she voted no. And then all the other counselors voted yes. So that's a sad thing. But we will work at it.
Keep us posted. Kim, we don't want to miss out on this one. We only have a couple minutes left. Performing your first one-woman show called Flying in the Dark. Tell us about this.
Yes, I am. I'm performing it for Toronto Visionaries. They've been having a series of concerts. I know they had Lucas Hanneman in January and Michael Arnouac. They had him most recently. And they're doing mine, my Flying in the Dark show, which is my first one-woman show, which I created in 2011. The updated version is has some nods to COVID and other things. I've kind of updated the ending of it. But I put up on the blog, I'm just looking for the email address. So you need to send a message to the email address in order to get the Zoom link for that. It is on the 19th of March at 7 p.m. And, my braille is doing something weird here. I'll get it in a minute. But I just also want to tell you that we are streaming Raising Stanley Vice with Tulia for Vocal Eye as well at the end of March. I'll have to stay up late because I don't have to perform it, but it's a streaming one. I think it might have been the show you went to, Kelly, because I think that was the one we recorded for archival purposes, but we're streaming that. So if people are interested in that, they need to go to Vocal Eye and register. And Amy Amanti and I will have a chat beforehand about this. So,
have it up on the blog.
It's
up on the blog.
We'll
it's
do
Toronto
that.
Visionaries that you, yeah. you go and get the Zoom password for that. info@ccbtorontovisionaries.ca is
awesome.
The email address for that.
Awesome, yeah. Kim. Boy, sounds busy. Congratulations again, and good luck on the show. Definitely, it's funny, Amy Amanti's joining us in a few minutes here on the roundtable. So, you know our small little AMI world. Thanks a lot.
We do. Well, thank you, guys, and stay safe and healthy, and see you next month.
You betcha. Kim Kilpatrick, our Canadian reporter in Ottawa, joins us. As she said, she'll be back next month with another report on the program. Go up to our blog, ami.ca/KellyCo, for all the information from our report. We'll take a break, and Andrea Voss from CNIAB Smart Life is here in just a moment. On Rogers Ignite, channel 146, you can find AMI Audio. And Bell Alliant, channel 66 in Atlantic Canada as well. Look for us over there. Visit ami.ca/schedules for a list of channel locations in your area. Kelly McDonald, the Thursday edition of Kelly and Company with Ramya Muthan.
Once a month, on the first Thursday, we like to chat with our friends from CNIB Smart Life, and we talk about a lot of different things. Today, we have a returning guest of the show, Andrea Voss, who we haven't spoke to in a long while, it seems.
A real long time.
Yeah.
Almost as long as I've been on the planet. So that's long!
No, not like dinosaur years.
Okay? Oh, that's true. That's true. She'd be fossilized.
That's right. Andrea, it's been a while. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. Thanks so much for having me back. I feel like I'm coming home a little bit, coming back to you
yes.
guys.
Yes. And you're welcome for that horrendous introduction.
Yeah, blame them for keeping you so busy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? I mean, I have to share you. And there's a lot of people that could really benefit from knowing what's going on with the offerings from CNIB Smart Life. So, but I'm excited to talk about my topic today.
Yeah, it's been beautiful,
Absolutely.
Though.
Absolutely.
Everybody coming on has been wonderful.
Yeah. It's been so great, a variety of things that we've been chatting about. So you're joining us from CNIB Frontier Accessibility, the Commercial Accessibility Manager for Ontario and the Atlantic Provinces, specializing in education. So we had lots of great conversations with you around that. We're going to talk today about Lego Braille bricks. And the last time this came up on the show, it was a hoot. So what are these Lego Braille bricks?
So the Lego Braille Brick, so this whole project is essentially a philanthropic endeavor from the Lego Foundation in Denmark. And they've been working on this project for many, many years. I think it's like 13 years. And these bricks are boxes of bricks. They're called tool kits or brick kits. And they have Braille. So if you can think about what a Lego brick looks like, this would be a brick that has been designed specifically to match letters and numbers in the Braille alphabet. And it also would have like a printed letter or number on it. So this is an endeavor for Lego because they know that people have been adapting their bricks as, you know, quasi Braille cells, for kids learning Braille. So what they've done is they've enabled something that they think is going to be an imaginative, fun way, learning through play. They've designed a whole pedagogy around it. And the goal is to get these kits into the hands of vision itinerant teachers across the country who are responsible for, you know, teaching Braille to children. And it's a free brick kit for those teachers.
Wow. It's really amazing because you think of so many educational toys that other kids get to play with and what's out there. And definitely, I mean, there's always been things that have been made accessible or created to support those of us in the low vision and blind community as kids growing up and help educate us at the same time. This took about 13 years to kind of go through the process of it. Tell us a little bit about that. I mean, I guess it's finding the right product with it, isn't it? And the right way to deliver.
Well, then think about this because, you know, this is Lego Foundation. This is, you know, something that they've invested millions of dollars in so they can provide it free, you know, for, you know, those end users. But when you think about Lego, you know, it doesn't matter what Lego set you have, Harry Potter, Jurassic Park, or farm animals, they always use the same kind of molds for their bricks. Mm-hmm. So whatever, that's the six dots, two dots, or, you know, whatever you want to call them.
Right.
But it's always the same molds. But with this, the reason why, or not the reason why, but part of the reason why it took so long is they had to create brand new molds for every single Braille letter and every single, You know, I mean, there's just so much investment in this. And they also, there was a lot of testing, and they just wanted to do it right. And of course, you know, this pedagogical approach that they have hired these expert Braille consultants from a company in France to design everything. So they have, I think it's 90 activities that that they have designed so far. And they are constantly, you know, providing webinars. It's all about really having vision itinerant teachers sign on to all that it is about learning through play. So it's, there's quite an approach to it. And that's why they are very adamant about giving these kits to teachers of Braille.
Yeah. And wow, like you said, because they want to deliver it for free, we can't necessarily think of this as a toy, right? Like the way you'd think of Lego generally.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, it is learning through play, but there's a whole, you know, pedagogy around it. So, it, you know, and we have a lot of people that have expressed interest in Lego, and there's always some eager parents that, you know, would love to get, you know, these kits into their hands and then, you know, be teaching their preschoolers. But really, you know, you wouldn't give Lego to a very young child because, in fact, I mean, Lego has a directive where you can't give it, give or allow a child who's less than the age of four to play with Lego because of the choking hazard. So really, this is a learning tool, I guess, for school-age children, really designed for people who are learning Braille anywhere between the age of 4 and 18. And I did want to say also with the pedagogy, they've got some really interesting, like a Facebook group for teachers to sign up. So they are very encouraging and collaborative. So if teachers have any ideas that they want to express to these consultants, they evaluate them and then possibly add them on to further the amount of activities that are available on the Lego Braille Brick site.
Okay. I'm trying to picture, Andrea, the if I picked up one of these bricks, my original thought when I first heard of and really not having a Lego collection for a little while, I'm thinking, oh, so is there Braille on the side? Is it shaped? Can you just kind of explain what it would look like for those of us who are blind and maybe Braille users out there trying to think, okay, well, how have they configured this if we haven't seen it?
Well, it would be, there is a board, like you would, you know, there are these flat boards that you can snap bricks onto.
Okay.
And they have, like, for example, if it's a Braille brick with the, you know, letter A, then they're only going to have that one cell.
One spot.
That's right. And then they will also, then it'll be flat outside of that one spot, but they will also have the printed A on that brick. So it's somewhat of an inclusive tool as well.
Perfect.
And and it's interesting because, you know, we are encouraging inclusivity, but, you know, in today's environment for learning, it's okay to learn on your own right now too. But I guess ideally, you know, it would be fun for, you know, people who need to learn Braille and also for their peers who just want to play along. They can, you know, do some collaborative games together and learning. So that's interesting.
Is there a color scheme? No, right? There would be one.
Yeah,
was
there is.
Okay.
Yeah. Now I can't exactly explain it, but they have, like, you know, they have certain colors for vowels and numbers and, you know, there's a total of 300 bricks in every kit. So depending on the language, because they're being distributed to 20 countries. So within each of those countries, for example, like the CNIB, we are the distributor. So it's our, you know, responsibility to make sure that the teachers receive these kits. But I think they all have about 300 bricks inside each kit. But depending on what language, you know, it is, like, I'm not sure if that determines how many vowels or how many consonants or, you know, whatever the thing is. It just really depends on the language.
I can understand more and more why it took so long to develop this, because there's different languages and all this other stuff.
Absolutely love that, though, the languages, because it's the only way you can make this inclusive as it is. The color scheme, so I do understand when you say 300 bricks and how to take, because, you know, you get thinking at first, what are we missing out on? How would we know? And we've had this conversation about Braille on the show before, because I don't have the perception really of the colors. I mean, when I could see more, I could pick up a brick and I guess this is a red one. I don't know. This might be a blue. And you just really worried about the shape. So trying to understand the educational way, the way that this has been put together for some of us, I know, is, wow, what the heck? How? That's really cool. So that's pretty amazing. Do you guys have them available too right now?
We have them at our CNIB 1929 Bayview site, and right now we are in the process of the distribution. So there's a few requirements for teachers who are looking to get their hands on a kit. We have about 2,000, well, there's supposed to be 2,000 English kits and 500 French, and the teachers need to register their interest by visiting our frontier-cnib site. We have a Lego Braille page, and there's a registration button on there. So people have to register their interest, and then they also must attend a webinar. And there's a whole list of webinars. Once they've attended, registered their interest, we would send them information about these webinars. But once those two things are completed, then they're eligible to have the kit shipped to them. And we are looking after that. So right now, we're in that distribution process. We're just beginning it. So it's very exciting. And of course, it takes up a lot of room at the CNIB, so we are trying to get these kits out.
That's a lot of kits.
That's it. Do you foresee them being available through other educational supply services like Scholar's Choice and some of them?
Well, I don't think so, because, you know, once upon a time, we were wondering, before, you know, when we had the contract, are these kits, will they be eventually for sale? But when we speak to the Lego Foundation, right now they don't have any plans that they're sharing with us anyway to sell them, because this is through their foundation. So they really, this is just, even though it's been 13 years in the making, I mean, they're just really, you know, launching it in 2021. So it's... I don't know, maybe years to come, but I'm not sure that we would be selling it. I think, you know, if Lego in the future wanted to do something, they would be doing it. But right now it's, you know, organizations like CNIB in Canada or APH in the US or RNIB in the UK, we're all sort of just trying to get the kits in the hands of the required end user, which is the educator.
Yeah, and honestly, like, you can tell with the marketing of this, and the what'd you call it again? The pedagogical approach. Like, you can tell
pedagogical.
And you can tell that it's very specific. You can obviously do so much with it in the education of it and how you go about using a kit like this, but it's meant to do something very specific, and which is why I can tell that they're not really about making a sale out of this. It's something completely different for them.
I just want to see it available to be ordered through places that educate kids, that have them in the mainstream. And I'm not just thinking here in Canada,
for the outreach.
We've got CNIB, but and more well known, so more educators can be aware of it.
Oh, sure, exactly. And who knows? Maybe that's the plan. But I think. You know, this is going to be, we're so excited about it, but just think about, you know, how exciting it would be to learn Braille using one of these kits.
Right?
Yeah, and sharing it with your siblings who also, young kids that say, you know, can you teach me, or I want to learn, you know, what a way for them to be able to do it themselves. Parents too.
Yes.
Everybody gathered around
playing.
Absolutely. Andrew, tell us how people can either reach out to you or you reach out to them to get a hold of these kits or to get people talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, you can reach out to me personally. My email address is andrea.voss, V as in Victor, O-S-S, at frontier-cnib.ca, or you can go to the frontier-cnib.ca website and go to the Lego page where we have a registration button, and you can register your interest there.
Awesome. Thanks so much. And again, it was so nice talking to you.
Yeah, great to talk with you guys, too. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for having me.
Thank you. We were speaking with Andrea Voss from CNIB Frontier Accessibility about the Lego Braille Bricks.
And amazing. For free, folks. Wow. We're going to take a break. And on the roundtable today, our special guest is Amy Amanti from Vancouver. We'll have a chat with her. We'll also listen to a voicemail. That's what will get us started as we discuss on the Thursday Kelly and Company Roundtable next.
Isn't it convenient that we have a round table?
Well, it's actually oval. Just say it.
The blind guy feels it now, goes, I guess it is oval.
Kind of oval.
Hanging out with you on a Thursday, wherever you are. Thanks for being with us. It's the Kelly and Company Roundtable. Ramya Muth and myself. And we always get joined by an awesome guest with us. This is put together really by myself finding a few things to discuss and throw them out on the proverbial roundtable. It's an open conversation. Today's guest is Amy Amanta. We know Amy from the network, being on as a community reporter on Now with Dave Brown, and we've had many conversations and heard this familiar voice, but particularly now her podcast, Accessing Art with Amy. Amy, welcome to the show, and let's start there. We want a little bit of promo work done to get people listening in, and you've had some, as we were speaking to you last week, Rumi and I, you've had some tremendous guests on Accessing Amy right from the beginning.
Aw, thanks, Kelly. Thanks, Ramya, for having me. Yeah, it's the podcast ride has been a roller coaster, and I am a big fan of roller coasters, so it's been a lot of fun to stretch my muscle and my network and finding people. Like, I know a lot of artists, and yeah, I went to a couple of people that I just thought, you're too cool not to have on here. Like, you know, what you do artistically is so fantastic, I just have to share. But to just stretch the muscle a little bit into finding people in, you know, parts of Europe and other parts of the world where I wouldn't have looked for them before. And now I have a reason to really look.
Artists speak well too, don't they? When you're putting together something like this, they find, I don't care if you're doing painting, you find the right selections of words to describe, to give people images, whether you're talking about painting, whether you're talking about acting. That's got to be really rich when you're doing the show.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's got a really different perspective. And what I really try to do is, like, I don't want to have, you know, 20 episodes with 20 actors.
Right.
It gets a little redundant. Yeah, yep. We'll have a handful of actors. But, like, the more unique the artistic practice, the more interesting it is to me. So, you know, I'm looking into a gentleman that is a sculptor, but his medium is cardboard, paper and cardboard.
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah. Who sculpts out of cardboard?
Yeah.
Right? So those kinds of things are really interesting to me in an art form that we just don't experience on a day-to-day basis.
With doing a podcast, Rum and I, our show is available via podcast, but we don't do anything. Agnew over there, he does all the work and gets it set up, and we just sit here and, I had a guy stop me the other day, and I know you from the podcast. And I'm like, oh. Okay. All right. And that's wonderful. It was beautiful to talk to him and really nice. But you have that other end of the stick working with Sam Robinson to put together the podcast. And what describe for us what goes on at your end.
Yeah. So I'm playing a couple of different roles. So I'm the producer of the podcast and then also the host. So a part of it is, you know, it's a lot of work, but also a lot of privilege because I get the opportunity to seek out guests, to choose guests, to format how I want the show to sound, and to explore these kinds of things. And, you know, you don't always get it, air quotes, right on the first episode. You know, sometimes you put the first episode together and you go, oh, you know, there really could be a cool sound effect right about here that will make things so much, you know, more audibly friendly. And then so, you know, maybe in episode 3, you start with this, you know, so like things sort of evolve. And that's kind of the fun of it for me is that it's never a stagnant thing, right? Like I'm looking at my podcast as almost a living thing. It grows, it can change, it can learn. And working with Sam is so great. You know, I send him some of my edit notes and some of my recording materials and, you know, he magically waves a wand and assembles them. I know that's oversimplifying things, but that's what it's like on my end. It's just like, here's the final product. And I'm like, oh, magic just happened.
Awesome.
So Amy, that's kind of fun.
I think that's just tremendous, and it sounds like it. Rum, I'm going to ask you something here about podcasts as a listener, as what you enjoy. When Amy mentions that, you know, it's a living thing, kind of grows, changes. I myself have never felt, I think when podcasts started, I don't want to say I expected a more amateur delivery, but not something that had to be so professional, fluid, broadcast. You know, it was more, and to hear voices that maybe that's not what their stick was, and almost a more honest presentation. Is that the term I can use?
I think so. I think there's some kind of comfort with not being associated to networks. And I'm seeing a lot of this now with just that, okay, well, I can start wherever and go wherever with it. And if people like it, then I'll just keep going, right? And if I like it, then I'll just keep going. There's that authenticity of honestly so many people just starting in their basements, their bedrooms with a $50 rental mic, like all these different things where you start because you want to get there. And there's not a lot of capital that you put into it at the start, but as you go, you grow. And as you grow, things become more of your niche. And see, like Amy, when you're talking about what exactly you're looking for, who you're scouting out for your kind of podcast, we can tell, like, okay, this is what your podcast means to you now. But maybe at the start, it wasn't like that. Maybe it was all kinds of directions. Let's just see where things end up. And then as you go, it just keeps becoming more you.
Well, one of the interesting things about podcasts is that there are so many different iterations. And as I've become a podcaster, I've been actually more interested in listening to other podcasts. Not that I wasn't before, but you listen with a different ear.
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
Exactly, Kelly. And so I'm listening to what people are doing and thinking, should I be doing something like that? Or, I'm doing this and they're not. I mean, I've been a guest myself on many a podcast, and they've all been so different. I just did a podcast out of the UK. Somebody found me, you know, just as I'm finding guests. And it was a, like, 93-minute podcast. You know, we just had a roundtable discussion that went on for 93 minutes. And before you know it, you know, you're almost at the 2-hour mark and they're like, yeah, we have no time. We just talk however long it takes. And, you know, so sometimes having some parameters in place can be helpful to the creative process, because I can't imagine listening back to a podcast that lasts for 2 or 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and it's been, you know, some of those rules that have come up more of late that people are starting. And just like you see the commercial broadcasters getting involved, and I don't want to say dirtying the podcasts up, but accepting that they're going to not sound as production and produced as some of their regular programming they run on their networks and stuff like that, and saying, hey, that's okay. But then there's some things that are podcasts that, my goodness, you can see the time people have taken to produce, throw that sound in, put that music in, acquire the music to use for it. So, Amy, I'm going to go back to a question that was asked of us recently. We had a caller. Now, the question kind of wondered, doing podcasting, and since we know that you also do some on-air interviewing, radio work, if you want, you know, that kind of thing. I want to know, and Rummy and I have bounced this around on air, do you feel if a person wants a career, that podcasting is a good way to lend itself to the education process, the experience process? Same with the other way around. We were kicking that back and forth with because there's people out there aspiring broadcasters.
Yeah, you know, I think podcasting is a really great place to start. And, you know, Ramya is absolutely right in terms of the, you know, the financial buy-in. You know, it takes a little bit more muscle work, you know, intellectual capital, a little more getting your hands dirty than it takes financial dollars to put it out there. So some of the benefits really for creating your own podcast is you're learning a new skill. If you're going to maybe, you know, try editing some sound effects in, you're going to have to learn how to use a program. Or you can say, I've got a 25-minute podcast. I'm going to, you know, hit record at second one, and I'm going to hit stop at minute 25. And what it is going to be what it's going to be, and no editing required. So there's lots of different ways of doing it. I think it's a great platform for providing content, providing education. I think for me, the other thing about it is that you just, you know, some, and I'm guilty of this too. I've wanted a YouTube channel for years. And I think to myself, well, where do I start? You know?
Yeah.
And you sometimes can talk yourself out of doing these things because, well, I don't have the right camera. Well, I don't have the right microphone. Well, I don't have a guest. Well, I don't. The list gets really long of the I don'ts. And it was actually so interesting to me because somebody recently, we were talking about systems, you know, colonialization and systems and how this is part of a system that's created. And who says that you can't just throw something out there and see if it sticks?
That's right.
You know, just take a risk, throw it out there and learn as you go. So, you know, if you're being backed by a big media conglomerate, they may not appreciate that. But if you're just a podcaster out of your basement, you get that luxury to kind of just play.
And take a chance.
And take some chances. Yeah. So yeah. The other part of it is you really got to tell people your podcast exists. So if you're trying to get a message out there, you're going to have to do some heavy lifting in terms of marketing or getting on social media and telling people, which is probably, I would suggest, is probably the hardest thing of the whole process for me. That's the hardest part.
I think so too.
Yeah.
And Rum, you've played around a bit with that in the sense of just throwing it out there and being brave.
Oh, yeah. Gosh, it is a huge balance of like being completely authentic to yourself and what you want to put out there as a podcast, but then also the other end of it, which you're like, well, do people want to listen to this? You know, how much of it can I market and do I market it this way or that? There's just so many questions. I'm like, can somebody else take over this part?
ladies, I'm going to switch gears. We had a voicemail from the aforementioned Robbie who kind of opened this little topic for us last week on the show. But Robbie dropped us a voicemail with a question I thought very apropos for us to discuss here on the Kelly and Company Roundtable.
Hey, Kels and Romy, it's Robbie again. Thanks so much for your feedback last show regarding the podcast and stuff like that. Thanks so much. Just another quick question. I'm just curious for both of you, what do you guys as blind or visually impaired people fear the most when traveling? I could tell you mine is a little bit of the wind and a little bit of the rain and a little bit of the snow. So I'm just curious, what is your what are your fears when it comes to traveling?
I did this for a Real Talk video. I think it was the wind for me, Ramya.
Ice is of late becoming the scariest thing for me when traveling. Yeah.
Wow. Aim?
Ice, no doubt. I mean, I live in a place that has no ice for the most part. We don't get a lot of frozen sidewalks in Vancouver. So that is not only the scariest thing for me, but the scariest thing, I think, for people around, whether you're driving or walking, because you're just not used to it. Mm. So it would be ice.
You ever have the combo of being on ice saying, oh, this and wind, and you're being pushed by the wind? As big as I am, I've felt like, man, I feel like a bad sailing ship.
I can't say I experience that often, but I used to experience that like when I would go skiing. And I would be up on the chairlift and you almost feel like the wind could knock you right off the chairlift. And you're like, maybe I should second guess this whole skiing idea.
Yeah.
It did run through my mind.
It's an interesting thing when you think about weather. And again, some people, what other people would think, like the snow because of the masking of sound. It's really interesting how you are able to adjust yourself and we all have our one thing that, oh my God. And everybody I think is the same. You talk to anyone who drives a car, you know, they'll say, no, man, I can't stand dry when there's any sleet or anything. Or, oh, they're talking about freezing rain tomorrow. I don't want to go out. It's so much that thing that can really create problems for us. And we all have innate fears of it, Rum.
Yeah. My mother, she gets winter tires. Like I'd say the latest, you know, early November, right? Or October even, I swear. But she's been driving for like 26 years now, very proficient. But if she hears anything about freezing rain or hail or hears anything that could resemble something turning into hail, that's it. She will not be on the roads. Like she will.
She changes completely, her plans. 100%.
Everything, even work, because she just won't. And she drives for all her work and she just won't. But I think I did tell you the story, Kells, on air a few years ago about it was windy and rainy outside, but apparently some of the rain from the night before had already frozen over. So I went out with an umbrella, opened it up, fell on my knees.
Yes.
The wind blew me back like 3 feet while I was on me. I was just sliding backwards and somebody around me was laughing, I'm pretty sure at me, before coming to help over, but my umbrella had flipped as well. So it was just like this wind tunnel with rain coming down with ice on the floor. And that was horrendous.
I would have been useless, Amy. I would have been that one laughing at her, and then I would have went down because the wind would have been blowing me. And
well, if
you
I didn't
know,
have to change my whole outfit after, oh, yeah, I would have been laughing.
It would have been a comedy of errors with the three of us there, like Larry, Moe, and Curly, right?
Yeah. Let me try to help you. No. I don't need your help.
Did I ever tell you all about, I'm sure that I did, but I'll just remind you that a couple years ago, we had this huge snowfall here in Vancouver. We seem to get one every couple of years. And I wrote a comedy skit around this. But one of the things that I was told from the most genuine little tiny small elderly woman, and we were waiting for the bus together on a dark, snowy, icky, slushy night in the winter. And she said to me quite candidly that, you know, her and her husband haven't been able to buy salt, you know, to put on the ground and to make things less slippery. And I must find it really difficult as a blind person to walk on ice. I said, yeah, it's challenging and I have to maintain my safety. And she said to me, you know what you should do? And I said, no, you know, like you have a conversation with a stranger at a bus stop. I said, no. She said, you should carry kitty litter around with you. And she said, if you sprinkle it on the ground when you walk, you could prevent yourself from sliding. And I just like, how, what is this? And then I kid you not, the bus pulls up like 10 minutes later. I go into the bus and the bus driver says to me, it's so dark outside. He said, I didn't even see your cane. You got to put like glow sticks on that thing or something.
Good grief. Everybody was full of advice.
Right. And so I took these two comments amongst a whole bunch of comments that people had made all winter. And I created a skit out of it, which I did performed on stage, which was a fantastic, like, audience roar. But that's the thing, like, people mean well, but they give you all this great advice that they think is really important to how you should live as a blind person. And then you're like, thanks. I'll take that under advisement. Thanks for sharing.
Great advice.
And that's all you need, right? Get hit by a vehicle because you were, like, it was too dark. They couldn't see your cane. And all people would be saying is, yeah, that's the odd lady that walks around Vancouver with kitty litter, right? Yeah, that's her. That's Amy, all right?
Has a podcast. Kitty litter in a fanny pack, right? That you got to take out and sprinkle like it's holy water across the ground. And it's like, sure.
Just for traction, right? Amy, tell us what's coming up on the podcast before we turn you loose.
All right. Well, today, actually, of all days, we have an episode that dropped featuring David Roach. And David Roach he's a friend of mine. I love him to pieces. And he's also in a new movie called Happy Face, which you can purchase in Canada on the Apple's iTunes store. And David lives with a facial difference. And if you listen to the podcast, I asked David how he would describe himself to somebody who was blind. And he comes up with some real interesting descriptions, you know, of in his words, which I thought was appropriate, instead of the assumption one would make on how you would describe somebody with a facial difference.
Fantastic. So
that was interesting to me. Yeah.
Awesome. Amy, good luck with the podcast. Thanks for making time. We'll have you back here on the roundtable soon.
Oh, anytime, my friends.
Accessing Art with Amy. As mentioned, episode drop today, so go check it out. Joining us on the Kelly and Company Roundtable. We'll take a break, see what's coming up tomorrow on our show, and now with Dave Brown. Saturday on The Pulse at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, Joita speaks with Scott Marchants, the director of a new documentary, Let 'Em Play, which discusses the journey of athletes with disabilities as they try to secure spots on the U.S. Paralympic team. Sunday at 10 a.m. Eastern, The Pulse interviews Vivian Lai from Autistics United Canada about the Disability Day of Mourning. That's The Pulse this weekend here on AMI Audio, also available as a podcast. Ramya Muth and Kelly McDonald, we're available as a podcast. Just simply search for us using your favorite podcatcher. And as mentioned, having Amy Amanti on here, we've got to give her show another shout out, as you can find Accessing Amy via podcast as well. Accessing Art with Amy. I was shortening that title, wasn't I, Amy? Sorry. Gotcha. Accessing Art with Amy. Rum, any segment you want to call out here quickly on the show?
Honestly, a lot of great segments today. I'm going to have to point out Samuel Peralta with the moon adventures that he talked about, some of the writing going to the moon. He has such a diverse background, being a physicist and a storyteller and a writer and amongst just scouting out talent, it seems, as well. And some of the things that are going to the moon, the project that he's put out there, as well as found other people to help put out there, like poetry and stories and all this other stuff. A lot of memory space being used. It was so cool to hear about. Very exciting stuff.
And Mike Fair, we talked about wellness apps, some things that he really himself had, as he disclosed to us, just needed to have some support because he was finding things rough, as we've all been doing, dealing with the pandemic. I'd like to invite in now Paul Daniel. He's the producer, one of the producers over there at Now with Dave Brown, to tell us about tomorrow's show starting at 9 a.m. Welcome back, Paul.
Hey, Kelly. Hey, Ramya.
Hey.
Tomorrow's show, the Friday news panel, will discuss the big issues of the week with Dave Brown. Entertainment critic Michael McNeely will preview the monster movie, Godzilla vs. King Kong. This time it's personal. Greg David from AMI's marketing department will discuss the upcoming season premiere of AMI TV's Our Community.
Sounds good, my friend. Thank you very much, Paul. Enjoy yourself. We'll talk to you next week.
Take care.
Paul Daniel letting us know what's coming up on Now with Dave Brown at 9 a.m. in the morning. They, too, available as a podcast. Rum will get things started at 2 p.m. Tomorrow.
That's right. We will. Friday show.
Yeah. Busy one. Good. Love it. Enjoy the night.
You, too.
Producer Jeff Ryman, he'll be on the show bringing us the latest lifestyle headlines. Now, here's something interesting. NASA's latest Mars rover has the same processor as an iMac from 1998. John Beeler, he'll be here to explain. The North Shore Disability Resource Center has a new mobile multi-sensory room. Sylvie Fiquette, she'll be here to tell us all about the space. Ryan Huey lets us in on great audiobook news, including Audible's ask to get active while listening to books in March. What a way to make the month move then. Also, Bill Shackleton joins us for the Friday Buzz with Bill. And let's get to conversation recaps and comment on segments from the past week on Cut for Time. That's all Friday here on Kelly and Company. Talk to you at 2 p.m. tomorrow Eastern Time. Late Edition, it's up next.
Do you return products? You know, things that you buy and you got to return because something's wrong with them or they don't fit or you just did a little too much shopping and you realize you don't need this anymore. I do not return anything. I really, really don't. Tons of clothing over the years have been donated because I'm way too lazy to return things, or I just find it completely inconvenient, or I wait too long. Oh, that's the other thing. I returned one thing in 2020, and that's because of price point. First of all, it was a technology and it was super expensive, the AirPod Pros. And well, now that I think about it, it was actually more of an exchange because I needed to get a new pair. There was something wrong with them and they wouldn't do the in-person thing because COVID. Yeah. So stuff usually just stays around the house until it gets either thrown out or given to someone else, most likely given to someone else because I don't like throwing out things either. That's a whole nother topic. But this happens like years later, most likely, you know? Let's just go down the list. Like hair products, kitchen appliances, lots of those I've given away. Clothing, donations. Shoes, donations. And I still have a few shoes in my closet that I just never wear. IKEA furniture, don't even ask. They sent me extra stuff. I didn't return it. Makeup, food, apps and program subscriptions. This one's cost me money over the years. Oh my gosh. Because I check my credit card bill and it's like, oh, I've still been paying for this for a year and a half. Whoops. And I think one time, even an event ticket that I couldn't make and I didn't return it. Wow, there's got to be an easier way to do this, right?
You've been listening to the complete Kelly and Company podcast experience.
The Real Deal airs weekdays from 2 to 4 p.m. Eastern on AMI Audio. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast platform.